is the Tom Hartman Program.
And happy Thursday, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you on this. Boy, it's getting very, very, very windy here in Washington, D.C. HSBC just got away with buying a cocaine plane. Really? This over at the Daily Beast. This is an amazing story. Let's check in with America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringofireradio.com, and one of the finest lawyers in the country. Hey, Pap.
Tom, how are you?
I'm great. Thank you for joining us. You've got some inside skinny on this HSBC thing.
Yeah, well, the drug plane is just a small part of it, but now we know what we've suspected all along. You know, Tom, the HSBC story is critically important for many reasons.
May I interrupt for a second?
Yeah, of course.
Just for our viewers or listeners who may not know what we're talking about, HSBC is, I think they're the biggest bank in the world, aren't they?
They are.
And it's a Swiss-based bank, but they do business in the United States. Okay, back to you.
Yeah, but they're one of many banks that are engaged in this same type of thing that I'm going to describe. But one reason this is an important story is Loretta Lynch, the woman Obama nominated for AG, was involved in giving HSBC a free pass for laundering money for drug cartels and for engineering treasonous illegal deals with both Iran and North Korea. She was the one that her name was on the charges. Another Eric Holder appointment, Lanny Brewer, who you might remember, was also involved in proclaiming that HSBC would not be prosecuted and instead they'd only pay a fine for conduct. Tom, it would have put the average American in prison for life.
Lanny was an old Clinton guy, wasn't he?
Worse than that. Yeah, the answer is yes, but let me tie it up even more. Lanny, you'll recall, was a Covington Burling lawyer. Covington Burling is a silk stocking Washington D.C. law firm that handle all the Wall Street mega thugs. Lanny Brewer and his Covington Burling firm gave five Wall Street mega banks a free pass for crimes that involve fraud, treason, money laundering, inside trading, price fixing, antitrust, theft, and even in more RICO events, Tom, than we could possibly cover in this short interview. No executives went to prison for any of that, for any reason. First, Covington Burling included Holder and then Brewer and then several other Covington Burling types that were deep-seated in the Department of Justice. And so their business is handling white-collar criminal cases. That's before Eric Holder was ever appointed. Huge amounts of money. If you add to this whole thing of why does all this happen, how does a bank like HSBC involved in laundering money for drug cartels, buying boats and airplanes that are used to transport drugs, how do they get away with it? Well, here's how it works out. Huge amounts of money have been given to Democratic political campaigns, including Obama's. And a huge amount of money goes all the way back to Bill Clinton, where all this love affair with Wall Street began. So in that love affair, all these Wall Street white-collar banking gangsters got such a free pass because during those Clinton years, Wall Street has methodically packed the SEC and the Justice Department with industry hacks that they could count on to hand out get out of jail passes to banking mobsters. So HSBC is an important story. Don't get me wrong, but it's only one small part of the big story. This story, understand, Tom, the DOJ has known about these crimes of HSBC for 5 years. And they took no action. What happened was you had an IT guy working for the bank that had all of the numbers, had everything about where all the bones were buried. He handed it to the French investigators. French investigators gave it to the United States 5 years ago. DOJ took no action, even though they had already placed HSBC in a deferred prosecution status, which means that they don't go, nobody goes to jail, they pay some fines, but they keep all their pals out of prison.
Is this also a case where the guy who was the whistleblower was the one who ended up going to jail?
Well, this guy did not go to jail.
Or was that UBS?
UBS and a couple of other very similar stories. But this guy had, he had all of the information. They threatened to prosecute him. I think the only reason he got out of my memory of it, I don't remember that part of the story in detail, Tom, but I can tell you this. What's important about the story is the United States was given notice of all this. And, but let me give you a contrast, Tom. Let me tell you how aggressively, while they were letting these thugs, these HSBC thugs get away, let me tell you what they were doing to little people. Two car dealers who accepted drug dealer money to buy automobiles went to prison for 50 months, 50 serious prison months. Two New Jersey businessmen lured into an HSBC tax scheme. Off to prison for that guy. A Virginia doctor who put his deceased mother, he put a little bit of money in an HSBC Swiss account, off to jail for that guy. Mississippi woman sentenced to 60 months in prison for laundering illegal money in her trucking business. 60 months for, I mean, we're talking about fractions of money. Truck driver sentenced to 50 months for taking $1 million across the Mexico line. But HSBC hid and laundered billions of dollars in cash for drug cartels and terrorists. And Loretta Lynch and the Covington Burling team, led by Lanny Brewer, who worked for Holder, decided that there's no crime too big for banksters where we actually name individual names and put these criminals in prison. This is an epidemic in the United States, and unfortunately, it's having an effect on the way we view criminal law in this country from top to bottom. You know, you'll put somebody in jail for stealing a Hostess Twinkie from a corner store, but where it comes to the person running that corner store who's stealing money from that employee by hustling them on time and, you know, skating time here and skating time there and making a dollar here and a dollar there off that time clock, we don't do anything about that. It's just a priority issue that's upside down right now, Tom.
Well, I've read several articles recently, and I think there's a couple of books out about this, about how the origins of policing, and that really policing began as these were the thugs who defended the interests of the rich people against the local community or against, you know, the poor. And you know, there's a piece on Huffington Post today about what do you do if the police stop you and you have money in your car or in your pocket, and they can just take it, you know?
So you go to the
there was this guy who had $11,000 in his pocket because he literally took it out of the bank to go buy a car to make a down payment, and they stopped him and they took away his money. He never got it. It's like, so if you're a little guy, they steal your money. If you're a rich guy and you're doing it with the banksters, it's all good.
Tom, I don't know how you characterize this as anything but third world banana republic quality justice system. I don't. Please help me with that, because I can't understand
we have a two-tier justice system. One, you know, one for the rich, the powerful, and the politically well-connected, and one for everybody else.
Well, for example, I mean, you know, we have a toothless enforcement system because at the top, now the toothless enforcement system at the top is set up to be like that. The aggressive, black boot system at the bottom, where we shoot kids in the street because they talk back to a police officer, kill them because we think they have a gun when they have, you know, a toy gun. All the stories we've seen over the last month. This system is so distinct that if we don't get it under control, how are we any different than Pinochet's Chile? How are we any different from any banana republic third world country? I don't see how we're different.
Yeah, I'm with you. In fact, I'd be inclined to say we have a three-tiered criminal justice system. The third tier is if you're a person of color being prosecuted. It's bizarre. America's lawyer, Mike Papantonio, host of Ring of Fire Radio, ringofireradio.com. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
Thanks for filling us in on all this stuff. This is astonishing. We'll be back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Pap's website, ringoffireradio.com. Check out the show, check out the podcast. It's up every weekend. So, Mr. Papantonio, what's going on this weekend on Free Speech TV with Ring of Fire?
We're going to talk about how Republican-controlled states are becoming cesspools of corruption and incompetence, and how, Tom, that's part of the plan. We take control of government state by state. county by county, judge by judge, city commissioner by city commissioner, and it all becomes this cesspool of corruption that has so much wind to the back that it's tough to stop. David Pakman is going to explain President Obama's proposal to provide 2 years of cost-free community college to American citizens, and what does that really mean? Does it really solve any of the problems? Brendan Fisher from the Center for Media and Democracy is going to give us the latest details on Scott Walker, on the John Doe investigation, and he'll tell us whether or not, yeah, interesting story. He's going to tell us whether or not Scott Walker can win on a national stage, even with all the barnacles. He's also going to talk about how this is not over. You've got Republicans and Democrats both going after Scott Walker because they realize that on a national stage, he's going to be an embarrassment to himself.
You know, I hear that, Pap, and I know the reality of that. But he's the guy that the Koch brothers have been supporting probably more than any other American politician over the last 5-6 years. And therefore, I think he's inevitable. I mean, George W. Bush had committed treason. He went AWOL during time of war for 14 months and never reported back. That's a hanging offense. And he became president of the United States.
It is. But you know what? At least there's a big difference between this guy Walker and Bush. Big difference. You talk about the Koch brothers. The Koch brothers also came up with Sarah Palin. They're the ones that pushed McCain into Sarah Palin.
Really?
Well, let me just tell you something. It was all part of the whole Koch organization.
Wow.
McCain understood he needed money. That's where Sarah Palin was launched. But on our show, David Haynes is going to talk about the dangers of blood monitoring. This new system is called Alera in Ratio, and it's very dangerous. He's going to talk about the overall failures of the FDA in recent years. The FDA knew for about 8 months that this system that people monitor their blood to see if it's too thick or too thin. They knew that it was a system that was not working. It was defective, and they had been told that 7 or 8 months they allowed the product to stay on the market anyway because of lobbying. They had people from Washington calling saying, the company decided to take it off of the market themselves, but there should be no mandatory recall. But it's just another picture of how dysfunctional the FDA has become and how medical devices and dangerous drugs there's a rampant problem out there right now because we have an FDA that, it's funny, Tom, most people think that if a drug's on the market, that the FDA has tested it. The FDA does no testing, zero testing.
Hmm.
So they completely rely on the drug company or the medical device company to tell them the truth. And we know from personal experience, having done this for 30 years, where I go after pharmaceutical companies and medical device companies, that about as high as 80% of the time, we will find documents that are very specific about how are we going to cover up the truth, bad clinicals or whatever it is. We got a good show lined up.
It sounds like it. I'm looking forward to it. Sunday noon Eastern time and, calibrate for the rest of the country. And, of course, it replays every day right here on Free Speech TV. Mike Papantonio, Ring of Fire. Thank you, Pap.
Thank you, Tom.
It's always great to see you. We will be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Okay, yesterday I went off on this screed, and I want to kind of build on it. There are a few other things that I think are really consequential, too, that are going on in the world. For example, the Republicans are getting ready to go after food stamps. They've already set in motion a 19% cut in Social Security. And, yes, the Republicans did that. In fact, they already voted on it. It's in the House rules now. And there are Democrats who are trying to stop that in its tracks, but the Republicans have set it up. Next is food stamps. Hey, we don't need no stinking social safety net. And I want to get to this larger question of why do we even have a country or an economy? What are our values as Americans? Why do we allow companies to exist, or do they allow us to exist? Get to that, but I wanted to start out with my riff yesterday about Iraq. I was suggesting at some length and in some detail that if we want to see the Middle East, if we want to see the Middle East end up being a rational place, you know, working out, we need to help bring them into the modern age. And the way you do that is not by bombing people. You don't blow up their buildings and their power stations and their water treatment plants. You build hospitals and power stations and water treatment plants. You create the infrastructure of a modern society, and very often modernity follows. Not always, though. Saudi Arabia, Kuwait, Qatar, the UAE, these countries have all the infrastructure of the modern world, and Saudi Arabia has the fourth largest military budget in the world. But would you call them fully modern democracies? No, not a chance. These are dictatorial kingdoms run by dictators who we're in bed with, and they work on crony capitalism. Most of the enterprises, many of the enterprises, are state-run, state-owned, or state private-public partnerships. But the interesting thing, and Andrew Cockburn wrote a fascinating piece about this over at The Independent, that I want to share some pieces of this with you. Actually, before I get to that, let me set this up a little bit better. So Senator Sanders, on this show a week ago, and I think 2 weeks ago, the last couple of times he's been on, he's been asked about Iraq. And I saw him yesterday on CNN as well, talking about this, as I recall. And Senator Sanders is basically saying, you know, I don't have a problem with us supporting a war against ISIS, you know, with airstrikes and things. But it really needs to be Saudi Arabia, UAE, Qatar. It needs to be the countries in the region who are all run by multi-billionaire families with multiple billionaires and very, very rich countries with enormous resource bases, advanced and sophisticated military capabilities. It's up to those countries to fight this war in their region. If you want ISIS taken out, if you follow his logic, if you want ISIS taken out, you say to Saudi Arabia, good luck, guys. You know, we'll back you up, but this is not our fight. Iraq and Syria, we're not talking Mexico here. There's no Monroe Doctrine. This is not our hemisphere, even. It's not even our continent. This is yours. So you guys, you know, put up the people, put up the money, put up the military equipment. We'll back you up. We'll replenish your military hardware. We'll even fly some strikes for you. We'll provide you with intelligence. There's a lot we can do to help. But Saudi Arabia, Qatar, UAE, you guys get in there. Now, all that sounds so logical and so reasonable. And I absolutely agree with Senator Sanders on that. And let me tell you the rest of the story, to paraphrase Paul Harvey, the late, great Paul Harvey. Patrick Cockburn, in the Sunday, July 13, 2004, this is the middle of last year, last summer, wrote what probably is the least well-known story that should be the most well-known story in the history of journalism on the Middle East. He says, sometime before 9/11, Prince Bandar bin Sultan. Now, Prince Bandar was the Saudi ambassador to the United States. He had been the head of Saudi intelligence. In fact, was up until just a few months ago. He was such a close friend of the Bush family. He was always hanging out with George Sr. back in the day when George Sr. was running the CIA and was vice president, was president. And then he started hanging out with George W., you know, holding hands, kissing, sleeping at the ranch, the whole bit. So anyhow, Prince Bandar bin Sultan had a revealing and ominous conversation with the head of the British Secret Intelligence Service, MI6, Sir Richard Dearlove. Prince Bandar told him, quote, now keep in mind, this article was written 6 months ago. It's about a conversation that happened 2 years ago, or there a couple of years ago. Prince Bandar told the head of MI6, quote, the time is not far off in the Middle East, Richard, when it will be literally God help the Shia. More than a billion Sunnis have simply had enough of them. Now, there are Shia in the west of Saudi Arabia. The Assad government, Assad is an Alawite, which is sort of like from the Shia. The Iranians are Shia. There was a Shia takeover, basically, of Iraq when we turned it over to Maliki. And so what happened? Well, according to Andrew Cockburn, the Saudis financed this fighting force to take on the Shias in Syria and in Iraq. And that fighting force we call ISIS or ISIL.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
So Prince Bandar and his buddies in Saudi Arabia and the rest of these Sunni billionaires in the region, they apparently funded ISIL. How are they going to fight it? Very planesthetically ugly, the good. Margaret Chan, during a speech in Singapore Tuesday, the World Health Organization head endorsed universal health care as a tool to fight income inequality. She said universal health coverage is one of the most powerful social equalizers among all policy options. It is the ultimate expression of fairness. Health systems will not automatically gravitate toward greater equity or naturally evolve toward universal coverage. All of these outcomes require deliberate policy decisions. I couldn't agree more. Let's hope Congress is listening and gets to work trying to pass John Conyers' single-payer bill, House Resolution 676. The bad. David Moore. After naked bikers rode through his town this past summer, the Montana Republican decided to take action. So on Tuesday, he proposed a bill in the state legislature that would clamp down on nudists and, well, pretty much everyone not wearing a burqa. According to the Billings Gazette, Moore's bill would expand indecent exposure laws to include any nipple exposure, including men's, shirtless men, and any garment that, quote, gives the appearance or simulates a person's buttocks, genitals, pelvic area, or female nipple. Oh, and as if that wasn't bad enough, when asked about whether the proposed law would affect tight clothing like yoga pants, Moore said, yoga pants should be illegal in public anyway. Something tells me David Moore would feel right at home with the Taliban. And the very, very ugly Joel Pollack. The Breitbart, California editor is under fire this week for a tweet he sent out about Kayla Mueller, the 26-year-old aid worker who was murdered by ISIS. Responding to news that Mueller supported the Palestinian cause, Pollack said, sad that Kayla Mueller was an anti-Israel activist. If she understood both sides, she might have avoided idealizing the enemy that killed her. Translation, Kayla Mueller's death is her own fault because she cared too much about Muslims. That is very, very ugly. That's mind-bogglingly ugly. So let me finish this rant. And there's a few other things that I said I want to get to, and we'll pick up your phone calls in just a second, too. But So a year or two ago, Richard Dearlove is the head of MI6, the British equivalent of the CIA. Prince Bandar bin Sultan, Bandar Bush, the head of Saudi security, or the head of Saudi's equivalent of the CIA, and the one-time U.S. ambassador, says to the British head of their CIA, their MI6, he says, the time is not far off in the Middle East, Richard, when it will be literally God help the Shia. More than a billion Sunnis have simply had enough of them. Now, Dearlove headed MI6 from 1999 to 2004. He says, according to this article by Cockburn, he's speaking of Dearlove. He does not doubt the substantial and sustained funding from private donors in Saudi Arabia and Qatar, to which the authorities may have turned a blind eye has played a central role in the ISIS surge into Sunni areas of Iraq. So in other words, the head of the British MI6, the British CIA, says, no doubt about it. ISIS is doing their work because Saudi Arabia is paying them. And not just Saudi Arabia, Qatar as well. Cockburn refers to this as Dear Love's explosive revelation. He says it has attracted surprisingly little attention. There were several articles about his interview, but virtually none of them mentioned his making that comment. Cockburn goes on to say, Dear Love sees Saudi strategic thinking as being shaped by two deeply seated beliefs or attitudes. First, they are convinced that there can, quote, be no legitimate or admissible challenge to the Islamic purity of their Wahhabi credentials as guardians of Islam's holiest shrines. In other words, the Saudis are not interested in becoming more modern. They're not interested in becoming more tolerant. They're not interested in adopting a less 18th century version of Islam. They're totally in with Wahhabism. Perhaps more significantly, Cockburn writes, the Saudis believe that they possess a monopoly of Islamic truth, and this leads them to, quote, be deeply attracted toward any militancy which can effectively challenge Shiadom. Coburn. Am I saying Cockburn? It's Coburn. No, it's pronounced Coburn, but it's spelled Cockburn. Okay. I've never met the guy or talked to him to the rest of it. In any case, so Andrew Coburn writing about this. Basically, the Sunnis, the Saudis, think that one of their jobs is to wipe out the Shia. Now, Saddam Hussein held this belief, too. He killed a million Shia on the Iraq-Iran border. We helped him. Don Rumsfeld went over and sold him the poison gas. Coburn points out that 15 out of 19 of the 9/11 hijackers were Saudi, as was bin Laden, and most of the private donors who funded 9/11. That's that 28-page report that the Senate came up with that we are still not allowed to see. That people like Bob Graham, who helped write it, the former senator from Florida, says, you've got to see this. I mean, you know, Saudi Arabia paid for 9/11, essentially. He goes on to note, and this was astonishing. When I read this, I just, you know, my jaw dropped. United States Secretary of State Hillary Clinton wrote in a December 2009 cable. Now, this came out of WikiLeaks. This is how we found out about this. Quote, Saudi Arabia remains a critical financial support base for Al-Qaeda, the Taliban, and LET, which is Lashkar-e-Taliba in Pakistan, and other terrorist groups. This is the Secretary of State of the United States writing in a secure diplomatic cable to the State Department or to somebody else in the U.S. government that Saudi Arabia is funding terrorism in the region. Coburn goes on to say, you know, for all of Maliki, you know, we propped up the Maliki government, but it became a Shiite government in Iraq. So the Saudis were not happy with that. So how do we change this to a Sunni government like it used to be with Saddam? Well, let's send in some Sunni fighters. We'll call them ISIS. Andrew Coburn writes, for all his gargantuan mistakes, Maliki's failings were not the reason why the Iraqi state is disintegrating. What destabilized Iraq from 2011 was the revolt of the Sunni in Syria and the takeover of that revolt by jihadis, who were often sponsored by donors in Saudi Arabia, Qatar, Kuwait, and the UAE, the United Arab Emirates. He writes, Saudi Arabia has created a Frankenstein's monster over which it's rapidly losing control. The same is true of its allies such as Turkey. You know, there are stories out now, and I think that they're reasonably credible, that Turkey's actually supporting ISIS, if not directly and explicitly, then indirectly, because the Kurdistan, the Kurds, used to, you know, the old Kurdistan country used to be part of Turkey, part of Syria, part of Iraq. And the Kurds are reestablishing their presence in Turkey, Iraq, and Syria. And the number one thing that Erdogan, the president, prime minister, whatever, the chief cook and bottle washer in Turkey, hates is the Kurds. So, hey, you hate the Kurds, you support ISIS. Go take Mosul. Have fun. Well, Mosul's not in Turkey, but you get the point. In fact, Andrew Coburn says the same is true of its allies such as Turkey, which has been a vital back base for ISIS and Jihad al-Nusra by keeping the 510-mile-long Turkish-Syrian border open. As Kurdish-held border crossings fall to ISIS, Turkey will find it has a new neighbor of extraordinary violence. So, A, I think we need to be, if we're going to play a role in the region, it needs to be humanitarian supportive of civilization. B, if we're going to play a military role in the region, it needs to be secondary and subordinate to people in the region who we are allies with, and to accomplish some reasonable goal. And C, there's no reasonable goal that we should care about in that region, in my opinion, other than just general stability, which is historically what we've supported. It's one of the reasons why we supported dictators in the region, and we continue to support dictators in the region. Saudi royal family, they're dictators. So let them fight their own damn war, but let's do it with our eyes open. Right? To simply say, oh, yeah, Saudi Arabia, they got the fourth largest military budget in the world. Let them fight the war. We have to also point out, let them fight the war against the group, ISIS, that they created, that is carrying on their Wahhabist tradition. This is serious stuff. Why are we in the middle of this? I mean, outside of the stupid response to 9/11 that George W. Bush engaged in, thinking that it would allow him to privatize Social Security, you know, the Republican dream. He thought he could pull it off if only he had a war. So anyway, that's my rant on the topic. We'll pick up your thoughts. And then in the next hour, I want to get into this. There's a really consequential op-ed in today's New York Times about what our mission is, what our goals are, what our values are as a nation, and how that applies to business and governance.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And I got two new books out in paperback, Death in the Pines, a detective novel about GMO mushrooms, and Crash 2016. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Angelo in New Orleans, Louisiana, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. You wanted to go back to Pap's topic about the corporate felons. Angelo? You got to listen to your telephone, not the TV, because there's about a 30-second delay there. And, I can't wait. Let's see. Alan in Chiefland, Florida, watching Free Speech TV on the Dish Network. Hey, Alan, what's up?
Thank you for taking my call. I would just like to say that we view the Saudis as an ally, and I think that's our greatest mistake. They are not an ally. And the president says we are not at war with Islam. But there is a war between the Sunnis and the Shia, and it is Saudi Arabia and its allies that are continuing this war.
Right.
The public in Iran, the general public in Iran, have a better friendly attitude towards the United States than the general public in Saudi Arabia. And we need to change the equation. That's all I have to say. Thank you for taking my call.
You're welcome, Alan. I absolutely agree with you, and I'm very hopeful. Thank you for the call. I'm very hopeful that the president's negotiations with Iran will be successful. Prime Minister Netanyahu, notwithstanding all the efforts of Ron Dermer, Frank Luntz's protege, who's now the Israeli ambassador to the United States, a Republican operative, trying to just, totally politicize Netanyahu coming to the United States, the whole Iran speech. I mean, this is just a disaster. It's a political disaster. It's a multinational disaster. I mean, we just have to look at What we need to do is real simple. We need to mobilize the way we mobilized for World War II, or the way that we mobilized during the Great Depression. And we need to put a solar panel on every south-facing roof in the United States. We need to put windmills everywhere there's, you know, wind power collectors, everywhere there's a reasonable and steady amount of wind. And we need to get off of fossil fuels altogether. End the age of coal. Sorry, it's not the 16th century anymore. End the age of oil. No, it's not the 19th or 20th century anymore. End the age of natural gas. It is, you know, it's a transition fuel, but that's it. And let's go. We right now, we can go with 100% renewable fuels, and we can say to these folks in the Middle East who are sitting on all these giant oil wells, we can say, good luck. Hope you can drink that stuff, because we don't want it. Now, I realize there are others who will want it, you know, in China and Russia and Vietnam and Brazil. And, you know, there's a lot of developing countries that are still very, very into oil, and they're going to buy it. But why should we? We have the ability. We're the richest nation in the world. We have the ability to reboot our country in a way that is absolutely energy independent. What is preventing that? Energy billionaires. The Koch brothers inherited an oil company from Daddy Koch. ExxonMobil, it's not hereditary, but it might as well be. You got Rex Tillerson over there running ExxonMobil, funding climate change denying groups and all kinds of awful stuff. I mean, it's time for us to say enough already. Not going to do it. 10 minutes before the vote. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour. Tom Hartman here with you and Brian in Seattle. Hey, Brian, what's on your mind?
Well, I wanted to say I had an epiphany about your conversation yesterday about the terrorists, what they call it, the wall of terror or something like that. We have to break
the death cult I was referring to of ISIS.
Yeah, because my position was I thought we had with ISIS the only way we could. We just had to exterminate them, and you kind of brought a different, made me flip that position.
I think we need to deal with ISIS the way we dealt with the Nazis. You defeat them, and frankly, I don't think that's our job. I think it's the job of the other people in the region who they are threatening, which would be, you know, I mean, frankly, Saudi Arabia and Iran should get together and work on this, except that the Shia and the Sunnis hate each other so much. But number one, you defeat them, and then number two, you look among their leadership and their soldiers for those people who were the actual criminals and sociopaths. And typically it's a relatively small number. Everybody else is just a follower. And, you know, the followers, you label them. Hey, you used to be a Nazi soldier. They have to live with that the rest of their lives. You used to be an ISIS soldier. But the leadership, you put them in the International Court for Criminal Justice in The Hague. And the ones who were ordering the rapes and ordering the murders and ordering the villages to be burned, hang them, or at least keep them in prison for the rest of their lives.
Yeah, that'd be an excellent idea.
And what it does is it points out that they're criminals, and thus we're treating them in a criminal justice system. It doesn't give them the glory of saying, oh, I'm a George Washington freedom fighter trying to overcome oppression. No, you're a criminal. You know, that's what we would be saying to them. So, you know, that's my suggestion of, you know, what we should do. Brian, thank you for the call. Rick in Durham, California. Hey, Rick, what's up?
Hey, Tom, thank you for taking my call.
Sure.
In response to what you just said, I wrote the International Criminal Court asking them to prosecute George W. Bush for his torture, his war crimes. I never heard back from him. So as far as I'm concerned, the International Criminal Court is a joke. But that's just in response to your comment right now.
Yeah.
They will prosecute little players, little fish around the world, you know, at the behest of the bigger governments like the United States. They're not going to prosecute George W. Bush by any stretch of the imagination. The United States.
No, they're not. But they might prosecute the leadership of ISIL.
Yeah, well, you know, they could just prosecute him right there, either in Iraq or prosecute him in Syria, too. But, you know, this morning I was listening to Amy Goodman, and she reports that there's 200,000 ISIS, at least white people who identify as ISIS. I don't know if they're all fighters or not, but, you know, just a few weeks ago we were hearing the number at 10 or 20,000. And now it's up to 200,000.
Right.
I don't think it's just the Maliki government that is driving that. I think a good lot of it is our drone war all around the world that even targets children, you know, like Abdulrahman Awalaki sitting in a cafe in Yemen, 16 years old. Him and his 17-year-old cousin are killed by a drone strike, and I think 10 or 11 other people sitting in the open cafe killed. Got the 16-year-old over in Pakistan with his 12-year-old friend who was targeted because he had gone to a jirga to protest the U.S. drone strike.
Yeah.
And he was apparently, it has been reported that he was identified by a reward. Somebody got a reward for turning him in, and then he was targeted and killed.
Right.
You know, he got a 68-year-old grandmother in Waziristan, killed in front of her grandchildren, and then they said in the second Hellfire missile in there to try to kill the grandchildren.
Yeah.
And they injured them, but they didn't kill them. And over 3,000 people, mostly innocent people, have been killed. It's been reported. And you probably...
I understand what you're saying, and I agree that this is no way to effectively fight terrorism. And I think that we're going to look back on this years from now and say that just like Iraq and Afghanistan invasions by George W. Bush were, you know, foreign policy blunders of an order of magnitude beyond anything we've ever done in the history of the United States, that the drone wars were a significant mistake as well. That said, though, if you look at who makes up the ISIL fighters, they tend to be Saudi volunteers, number one. Number two, volunteers from the other Sunni countries in the region, Kuwait, Qatar, UAE. Number three, Sunnis who were part of the government and used to work in the Saddam Hussein era from Iraq, who have been disenfranchised first by L. Paul Bremer and then by Maliki. And so there's this collection of, there's some who are religious fanatics. There are some who are just thugs. There are some who are idealists. They're bent on creating a paradisiacal state, you know, we can rule ourselves. I mean, it's a complex thing. It's not just, you know, it's not like we're dealing with Billy the Kid here or something. You know, it's not one whole, you know, coherent and whole thing. And they're getting a hell of a lot of money from Saudi Arabia and have been. And there's a whole bunch of reasons why we need to deal with all these things all at the same time. So, Rick, thank you for the call. I appreciate it. Ken in Great Falls, Montana. Got a minute to the end of the hour. Ken, it's yours.
Yeah, Tom. You know, back in 84, I was on a project in the Peace Corps in Morocco. It was a project that Carter had set up to bring renewable energy to Morocco and a bunch of the other Arab countries, because most of them don't have oil and they're under the thumb of the Saudis and the people with the oil.
Mm-hmm.
And you know, the idea that you talked about earlier, but bringing renewable energy, it would solve so many problems with the evil oil money.
Yeah,
and it would be so easy, like you said, on a World War II type basis. I mean, you could take a $1 trillion bond from the American government, use all that $1 trillion to buy solar panels, put them on people's houses. The people would pay off the bond instead of buying energy.
Yeah, this is how Germany did it. They subsidized.
To be done.
Yeah, Germany said, you know, backstopped mortgages, 10-year mortgages for solar panels for the roof of your house, and after 10 years they're paid off, and now you've got solar power for the rest of your life for free. And it is, you know, they're getting, they had one day last summer where half of all of the electricity in the country was generated by those solar panels. It is something that is clearly within our grasp. Ken, thank you.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
This is the Tom Hartmann Program.
Hey, welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. By the way, my article, The Right's Sinister Plot to Destroy Social Security Reveal, just got picked up over at Salon.com. It's also from, it originated on alternate.org, and it seems to be floating around the internet. But it's about Jude Winiski and the two Santa Claus theories. So you might want to check that out. Share it with your friends. Okay, for the second hour, we can, excuse me, don't eat apples during your break. excuse me. For the second hour, I wanted to get into this issue of what the purpose is. Mark Bittman wrote this piece for the New York Times, so they got me thinking about this. And this is something that I talk about a lot. But I want to just be very clear and explicit about it and share with you my worldview on this and get your thoughts on your worldview on this. Where do we go with this? What do we do with this? Mark Bittman is he's a progressive. He writes for the op-ed pages of the New York Times. And he's talking about how food, the situation with food, farming, factory farming, destruction of soil, 30, 40, 50,000 people getting sick from foodborne illness, all that stuff, every, you know, across the United States, is a symptom that something has gone horribly wrong. We have a food system in the United States that is producing an epidemic of obesity, an epidemic of type 2 diabetes, an epidemic of heart disease, an epidemic of celiac and IBS, and with a large debate about what's causing that, whether it has to do with glyphosate or other compounds. We have a food system that's failing us. It's destroying our soil, but it is making a small number of people mind-bogglingly rich. You get people like Joni Ernst, the new senator from, what is it, Iowa, I think, whose family took almost $500,000 in subsidies from the federal government. So you got farmers who are doing well. You've got a bunch of farmers in Congress who are pulling down hundreds of thousands, in some cases millions of dollars in subsidies from the federal government for their various businesses, many of them agricultural. But even worse, you've got, you know, I mean, Walmart has now moved into groceries. The Walton family is getting richer on this. So the question then becomes, why do we grow food? Just as a starting point. There's really a relatively binary choice. There's obviously some gray area in the middle. But as a statement of purpose, as a country, why do we grow food? Most of us would say we grow food so that we can have a decent life, you know, so we can live. Food is necessary for survival. But if that's true, then why is so much of the American food supply actually poisonous? It's actually killing us or sickening us or preventing us from having optimal health. Why is it so much of our food supply is in such bad shape? And the only possible answer is that we don't produce food in the United States for the public good. If we did, we wouldn't be sterilizing our soil with chemicals. We wouldn't be, you know, contaminating our environment with genetically modified organisms. You know, none of this stuff would be going on if we were producing food for a public good. But we're not producing food for a public good. We're producing food to make money for somebody. This is how twisted things have become in the United States, particularly over the past 30 or 40 years. This is the logical conclusion of the whole Reaganomics thing, that the only good people are the capitalists. The rich people are the ones who are going to lead us. The workers should just take their lot in life and suck it up. And sorry you can't have a union anymore. Sorry you can't go to college for free anymore. Sorry if you lose your job, you don't get any unemployment insurance. This has been the Republican mantra for 35 years now, and they're putting it on steroids. Now it's sorry, in a year and a half, we just put this into place. The Republicans did in the House of Representatives in about a year and a half, a 19% cut in Social Security disability insurance that people paid into their entire lives. Republicans want to cut that. Why would they want to cut it? Well, for the same reason that they cut Medicare so many times. Say, wait a minute, the Republicans cut Medicare? Yeah, of course, they drill holes in Medicare so that then United Healthcare and AARP can come in and say, hey, we'll sell you a supplemental policy to fill that hole that our Republican buddies in the House of Representatives and the Senate drilled into it. They're just going to do the same thing with Social Security. If they cut Social Security benefits by 20%, then they'll say, hey, you know, you could always buy a disability policy from United Healthcare or somebody like that. Actually, IAG sells them. Aren't they wonderful? I mean, you know, we bailed them out. Hey, put them to some productive use. Mark Bittman says, and I absolutely believe that this sentiment is one of the most important things that we all need to be talking about, that we need to be talking to our politicians about, and that in particular we need to be leaning on Democratic politicians and the Hillary Clinton campaign over, because in all probability she will be the nominee of the Democratic Party. And here's what Bittman says in today's New York Times in the op-ed pages. The article is, What is the Purpose of Society? He says, progressives are not thinking broadly or creatively enough. By failing to pressure Democrats to take strong stands on everything, from environmental protection to gun control to income inequality, progressives allow the party to use populist rhetoric while making America safer for business than it is for Americans. Why do we have government? According to the Constitution, we the people created government in order to form a more perfect union and provide for the general welfare of our people. According to the Declaration of Independence, we did it so that we could all have life, liberty, and we could even pursue happiness. Now, how do you pursue happiness if you're working three jobs and making $16,000 a year when you got a couple of kids and you can't afford anything? But it goes beyond that. Mark Bittman says, shouldn't adequate shelter, clothing, food, and health care be universal? This was the essence of Franklin Roosevelt's second Bill of Rights. With his second, which I'll play clips for you when we come back from the break at 20 after. But basically what Franklin Roosevelt said is, okay, we got this thing down about, you know, we're free of England, we're free of foreign domination. And as of 1940, when he came, or 41, whatever year it was that he came up with his second Bill of Rights, as of that point in time, he had even gotten the capitalists under control to a certain extent. He had gotten unions, the right to unionize passed over their objections. He had ended child labor over their objections. He had ended child prostitution over their objections. All these things, they said, oh, it's the right to contract. Right. He was integrating the military. The list goes on and on of the New Deal. You know, unemployment, long-term unemployment insurance. The government is the employer of last resort. So he says, okay, we've got this stuff under control. What's next? Well, what's next is that food, clothing, and health care should be rights.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
Now, a right is a very different thing from a privilege. And you and I and the rest of the progressive movement need to begin this conversation loudly. Welcome back. Let's see here. Bob, watching Free Speech TV in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. Hey, Bob.
Hello, Tom. I just want to say, and you could ask me to put this in a context if you'd like, but I just want to say that people who threaten people who are trying to do good work in society, people are being threatened with other people's violence in order to keep them from doing the good work that they do in their communities, in their states, in the country, on the land. I hear this. I've heard this for years, and all through back through time and the work I've done. When I protested outside of a nuclear processing plant down here, we organized, we camped out to make an issue about it. The Blues Brothers and Kerr McGee before that. We protested down there, and people were warning me, oh, you don't want to do that. You don't want to protest against the nuclear industry. They'll kill you. And I was like, whoa. You know, we went ahead and did things. Nobody's getting killed. Every now and then, people do get killed.
Well, they killed Karen Silkwood.
People do get targeted. But there's a lot of this angst amongst the common public that, oh, you don't want to speak up against the violence of what cannabis prohibition does, for instance, or they'll come after you, you know. So nobody's really having a discussion about how farmers could make a better world by raising industrial hemp on their farms, and how people need to be left alone to grow their own marijuana if they choose to. And there's no discussion about this. Bernie Sanders won't touch it with a 10-foot pole, and neither will Sherrod Brown or anybody else. And so what's going on here that we can't speak on Free Speech TV about this, as Jack Herrera so eloquently outlined in his book, The Emperor Wears No Clothes? What's going on here, Tom, that we can't talk about this in real time, in real terms? What's going on in Colorado?
Are we not talking about it right now, Bob?
In Washington State, that is so good for this country. If we can't end prohibition and get rid of people like Chuck Grassley once and for all and Jim Inhofe, then what's wrong with this country?
Bob, we're having that conversation. You got two states that have decriminalized pot. You've got three others, arguably, include D.C., that will be doing it this year. You've got one state. I forget which state it was. Was it California? Just said industrial hemp can be grown, and they're promoting that. Bob, I think that you're winning the war that you're complaining about not being able to fight.
I think the common public will not discuss this issue.
Oh, sure they do.
There's no real public.
The majority of Americans are in favor of pot decriminalization, and frankly, the majority of Americans don't know the difference between industrial hemp and pot. But if they did,
I don't think that's true. I think there's a lot of information out there that people are talking about, but not on the air.
Yeah. Well, it may well be. It may well be, but I've talked about a fair amount here. Of course, it's not my job to defend my show. I mean, I do what I do. But and Bob, I get it. This is your topic. In fact, I'm going to start calling you Bob Legalize Hemp in Tahlequah, Oklahoma. And I'm with you. I mean, last night on the TV show, we did a whole 7-minute segment where we were trying to figure out, you know, what's D.C. going to do? Because you got Andy Harris and the Republicans here in the House of Representatives trying to stop the city of Washington, D.C. from having legal pot stores. This is terrible. For the sane among us, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, fair and only slightly unbalanced. Now, to this point, here's the difference between a right and a privilege at law. If you have a privilege, Like, for example, you have the privilege of starting a business. You don't have an absolute right to start a business. There are a lot of things that could be done to prevent you from starting a business. People can't put you in jail. People can't be put in jail for doing. Although, you know, there are some restrictions. You know, if you're female, if you're a person of color, if you're a person of a certain religion, and somebody tries to stop you from doing a business on that basis, then, you know, that's a problem. But basically, you don't have a right to it. You have it's a privilege. And in exchange for that privilege of running a business, you have to run the business according to the rules. You've got to report your taxes every year. You've got to pay your employees a certain minimum wage. You can't, you know, dump poison in the rivers and streams. It's just basic rules. So why do we have business? To serve the public good. Why do we grow food? To serve the public good. Why do we do pretty much anything? To serve the public good. So, these are privileges. Privileges you can claim, but you don't always get. Rights, when something is enshrined as a right, then the government has to do everything they can to clear obstacles out of your way so that it's available to you, it's accessible to you. And in fact, if you can't get it from any other source, the government has an obligation to provide it to you. You have a right to a primary education in every state in the union. And government must educate you or your children. You have a right. Now, in other countries, there are other things that are rights as well. And you know, the government either provides them or figures out a way to make sure that you get them. And here's FDR proposing that we amend the Constitution to the United States to expand our definition of rights. Here he is.
In our day, certain economic proofs have become accepted as self-evident. A second Bill of Rights, under which a new basis of security and prosperity can be established for all, regardless of station or race or creed.
Okay, so number one, he's saying we want to establish these rights, and we also want to make sure that nobody can discriminate against you in your exercise of them. What are those rights? Franklin Roosevelt.
Among these are the right to a useful and remunerative job, the right to earn enough to provide adequate food and clothing and recreation.
Now, having the right to a job that earns enough to actually raise a family could be played out one of two ways, or both. Number one, you can talk about the minimum wage. But number two, what if capitalism has failed, or what if stupid public policy like free trade agreements have failed us, and there's no good jobs to be had? What if the Republicans continue to allow McDonald's and Walmart and whatnot to game the system and pay people so little that they qualify for welfare? That's not a fully remunerative job. Well, if it's enshrined as a right, then Walmart wouldn't be able to do that. McDonald's wouldn't be able to do that. And when there are people who are unemployed, rather than sending them an unemployment check, which John Boehner cut off a year and a half ago or a year, 13 months ago, instead of putting people on unemployment, you could put them on a government job. You can give them a decent job that actually pays well. So the government becomes the employer of last resort when capitalism fails. That's the first. Next.
The right of every farmer to raise and sell his products at a return which will give him and his family a decent living.
Now, keep in mind, when Franklin Roosevelt said this, about a third of the American economy was agricultural. So he was talking to a hell of a lot of people. I mean, there were more farmers than there were machinists or even people working in car factories. But that said, I think that we need to return to something like that. We have industrialized agriculture, and it is causing massive suffering among our food animals, which includes those that secrete milk and lay eggs. Massive suffering. It's harming the public health. We're doing it with this whole antibiotic thing in a way that is causing antibiotic resistance, which is going to be the next major epidemic that we will have no way to deal with here in the United States. Already is antibiotic resistant bacteria. as a result of factory farming. We're destroying our soil. We have this started in the 80s when Reagan started, you know, stopped enforcing the Sherman Act and allowed these giant industrial agricultural combines to start buying up farms. I grew up in Michigan. I grew up at the south end of Lansing, Michigan, and just, I mean, literally a half a mile from me where the farmland began. And I had friends. I went to school with kids who were farmers. And they all owned their own land. This was in the 50s and 60s. By the late 80s, pretty much everybody I knew who had been a farmer now had their farm had been bought by one of the big ag companies, and if they continued to farm that land, they did so as employees of that big company or as contractors to that big company. Let's break those back up. Let's go back to agricultural practices, which are actually more productive, not as profitable for Monsanto or Dow, not as profitable for the big ag billionaires, but more productive for you and me. So that was number two. Number three is
the right of every businessman, large and small, to trade in an atmosphere of freedom, freedom from unfair competition and domination by monopolies at home or abroad.
You have a right, if you're running a business, not to get squashed like a bug by a monopoly like Microsoft or Comcast or Verizon or whatever it may be. You have a right to not have monopoly in your face. If we put this into the Constitution, Reagan couldn't say, oh, yeah, we're going to let these monopolies take over every industry in the United States. We're going to let, you know, all the radio and TV stations in the country be owned by two or three companies. No, he couldn't do it. Because you have a right to have competition.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
It's not just that you have a right to have competition. You have a right to be the competition. More of these rights right after this. Defending America from the weapons of mass deception. Tom Hartman here with you. Back to this conversation that we were having in the United States in the 1940s with Franklin Roosevelt, that everybody knew we were having a conversation about, and then, you know, we sort of stopped talking about it. I mean, World War II happened, yeah. And then Harry Truman, who was, he was an okay president, but he wasn't the brightest bulb in the tree. And then the Republicans took the House and the Senate for 2 years, 1946-47, or 47-48, the election of 46. And screwed everything up from Taft-Hartley on down. They did such a terrible job that the Republicans didn't take the House of Representatives for over 40 years. Americans figured out what the Republicans were all about. But we never got back to the conversation, which is what should be a right and what should be a privilege in the United States. And those things that should be rights, they should be absolute rights, which means that we, the people, will make sure that they get accomplished if capitalism fails to do so. There, you know, to quote Roosevelt, the spokesman for power and privilege, right, the shills for the Koch brothers, and the other right-wing billionaires in this country, they will tell you that the purpose of our country is to have an economy, and the purpose of the economy is so some people can get rich. I would say not true. I would say the purpose of an economy is to do what's best for the country. And some people getting rich is a side effect of it. So anyhow, we've talked about having a right to a job, which means the government becomes the employer of last resort. Keep in mind, you have a right to, your child has a right to an education. Now, yes, the Republicans are trying to chop away at that, you know, with voucherizing schools and charter schools and private schools and everything else. But still, it's at law that you have, your child has a right to a free public education, a quality education. So FDR is saying you should have a right, not just to a job, but to a job that pays enough. You should have a right to, what else did we cover? To have a successful farming enterprise, in other words, to be a small business person and to run a farm. And you should have the right to run a business without it being without it being destroyed by fat cats, by monopolists. Here's what's next.
The right of every family to a decent home. The right to adequate medical care. and the opportunity to achieve and enjoy good health.
Housing and health care should be rights. We have millions of people in the United States living on the streets. We also have millions of empty homes and housing units. You think we could get these two things together? And health care, every other developed country in the world says that health care is a basic human right for their citizens, except the United States. In the United States, health care is an opportunity for people like Rick Scott to get rich. Now, granted, Rick Scott did it in part with fraud. His company was convicted of the largest Medicare fraud in the history of the United States, and he went on to use his millions to get himself elected as governor of Florida. You know, you can fool some of the people all the time, apparently. But that's, you know, our consensus now is that health care is so that people can get rich, whether it's an individual star surgeon or whether it's a big health care company. Here's what's up next.
The right to adequate protection from the economic fears of old age, sickness, accident, and unemployment.
There you go. And we started down that road with Social Security. We took it a large step forward long after FDR was dead, when Lyndon Johnson in 1964 or 65 introduced Medicare and Medicaid. But now the Republicans are trying to roll those back, too. And finally,
the right to a good education.
Right. Which is, you know, arguably we've had. But let's enshrine these things in law. There's nothing radical about any of these things. In fact, according to the UN Declaration of Human Rights, everything that FDR just said is a right available to every person in the world. Now, the problem is the UN doesn't have any enforcement power. If they did, they could change our laws. But isn't it time for us to have this conversation about, you know, why do we allow big banks to exist? Is there some public purpose that is served by them? And if there isn't, let's stop allowing it. For example, okay, Terrell in Denver, Colorado. Hey, Terrell, what's on your mind?
Hey, how's it going?
Good.
I mean, the problem that we have here is that there's been a coup in our country by corporate America.
I would not disagree with that.
That's how we can't get anything done.
Yeah.
I mean, everything that is standing in the way of anything has the word money written right into it. Of how come it cannot happen. And somehow, from the Christian right, they've motivated and pretty much taught people that things are not, you know, they're pretty much socialized, leaving people behind.
Yeah. No, I'm with you, Terrell. And this, and we have had a coup, and it's exactly what Henry Wallace predicted back in 1944. And it was facilitated by Lewis Powell being put on the Supreme Court by Richard Nixon in 71 or 72, and his authoring the Buckley versus Vallejo decision in 76. We have had a coup. The Supreme Court turned political power over to corporations in a series of decisions from the 70s until now, and those corporations have stepped up to the bat and the billionaires along with them, and taken those things. And in the process, they've diminished our rights. Terrell, well said. Thank you. John in Minneapolis. Hey, John, what's up?
Yeah, I just wanted to say, you know, as far as values, you know, we're so skewed towards individualism to the point where it's ridiculous. There's no healthy tension between communitarian values and individual values, and i.e. meaning individual, meaning making, you know, people rich, I mean, or allowing them to scam the system to become rich. And I wanted to say, also, I'm a respiratory therapist. I've said that before. And just the other day, I had a really interesting conversation with a pulmonary doctor. And even people who are highly paid, they're leaving that profession. There isn't the, you know, they feel cowed by hospital administrators, one of which is going to be our former pulmonologist. And, you know, as this doctor said, he's gone over to the dark side. And I said, yeah, I said, isn't that a shame? And he said that there really isn't the reward for these highly skilled people. So the quality of medicine is going to go down, except at the legacy institutions like the Mayo Clinic, the Cleveland Clinic, Johns Hopkins, and places like this
that are used by rich people.
Be able to afford this privatization. And, you know, of course, rich people, when they're sick, they can afford to have the best of everything. I recently saw a patient, well, this happens now frequently, where we get a patient from an institution that can take care of them much better than I can where I'm at, because I'm in a subacute hospital that is a rehabilitation hospital / acute care hospital, but we don't have the tools to take care of patients that have, like, for instance, this patient had adult respiratory distress syndrome. He needs to have the kinds of things that can be provided at a university medical center. And here he is. He was basically dumped by the institution that he came from. And, you know, we're left holding the bag. And, you know, it's kind of sad because, you know, I don't know what we're going to do with him. If he's lucky, he will, you know, make it. His lungs will heal and he'll slowly get better. But if he gets sick, we're going to have to send him back. And I, you know, when do you make that decision? Often there's a lag between that. Right. So the quality of medicine, I think, is really suffering
right. Again,
under
because
the Republicans. So they say
because of the profit motive
in life. Yeah. But actually, they believe more in making money.
Yeah, I'm with you, and it's the profit motive that's driving everything. And the only thing that can balance, and the profit motive is not inherently evil. It's when it gets out of control that it becomes a force for evil. And the only thing that can balance that is either organized workers in the form of a union, or organized people, organized citizens in the form of government. John, thank you for the call. Rob in Mountain Iron, Minnesota. Hey, Rob, got a minute to the break. It's all yours.
Thank you very much, Tom. It's where, you know, like, we got a right to vote. Vote for our representatives. But guess what? Our democracy has been completely turned on its head, because right now the representatives are picking their voters because of oligarchy and gerrymandering.
You're right.
How are we going to get our right back to vote for our representatives like it's supposed to be?
Well, we never had a right to vote, Rob. The founders were very reluctant to put a right to vote into the Constitution for fear that either people of color or women would try to claim that right. And so there is no right to vote in the Constitution to this day. In fact, if you read Bush v. Gore, the Supreme Court case in 2000 that gave the White House to George W. Bush, they pointed out that, yeah, more people might have voted for Al Gore. More people did. 500,000 more people all across the United States voted for Al Gore than George Bush. But there is no explicit affirmative right to vote in the Constitution. And therefore, you know, tough luck. We're going to overrule, you know, what happened in Florida. We're not even going to count the votes. So I think in addition to the things that Franklin Roosevelt just listed, I'm with you, Rob. We should also add an affirmative right to vote, which means that if the Republicans want to come along and say, oh, yeah, you can vote unless you don't have the right kind of ID, which you're going to have to spend $75 to get your, you know, and this, that. They can't do that because that would be a violation of a right. Rob, thank you for that.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
We'll be back 15 minutes before the hour. Death in the Pines, The Crash of 2016, both out in paperback now. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And Dale in Harmony, North Carolina, watching Free Speech TV on DirecTV. Hey, Dale, what's up?
We are firsthand victims of this modern agriculture and all the food stuff, them using sulfuric acid to break starches down in your grain products there, and then feeding those byproducts to animals. And the antibiotics does not work. These animals have to be treated with B vitamins and steroids, just like you would if you had cerebral palsy. Or it causes the B vitamin that helps keep the brain calm down, because these animals, they go hallucinating, acting crazy.
Wow.
I'm basically disabled on account of being hurt treating on combative animals there.
Are you a farmer, Dale, or were you?
Well, yes, dairy farmer. And this is bankrupting farms all around here. And the thing about it is, the Agriculture Department has known about this on our farm for 5 years. They have not done one thing to educate the farmers about this out here. They're trying to keep it hush-hushed. the TV crew from Channel 9 out of Charlotte was out here, and four carloads of doctors and ag officials run as soon as that new satellite van pulled up on the farm and four or five other farmers there, because they did not want to have to answer no questions to the public out there.
So they're taking... tell me about the sulfuric acid. I didn't know about that. They're taking what? Go ahead.
That's the miracle in that water solution that they soak grains in to break the starches down, to use sulfuric acid to correct the pH in the water.
Uh-huh.
And it's called a wet milling process. And the same symptoms that we're seeing in our cows is the same symptoms that the general public and humans out here is having. Just the rates are lower for the humans than it is for the animals. They got the rates, they jacked the rates up higher for that could be blended in to the animal feed,
right.
Especially when they started making ethanol. They started using higher amounts of sulfuric acid so they could get more ethanol out of a bushel of corn.
Right.
And all them byproducts is coming back into animal feed there. And that's the reason you're having such outbreaks of cancer in your pets, like dogs and stuff like that, because all that stuff is being blended back in all kinds of animal feeds. And they allow two parts per million in human feed.
Yeah, Dale, I understand that there's a fairly high proportion of feed animals, cows, pigs, chickens, whatnot, that end up with neurological diseases, that end up with the equivalent of kind of Alzheimer's and dementia, that end up with neurotic, that have cancers and things.
Yeah.
Are you suggesting that there's been, that 40, 50 years ago when my wife's grandmother, ran a what we would call today an organic farm, they just didn't use any chemicals, they didn't know what organic was, back in Michigan, that most of her animals were healthy and not sick? Because I have no recollection of her ever having a sick animal.
The magazines, the farm magazines are just full of snake oil products there that's trying to cover up the damages for all of this stuff is causing.
Why not just go back to organic agriculture practices?
Hey, we had special order conventional corn so we could plant it last year. And the wildlife goes back to eating what you knock down at the edge or something. They go back to eating that, where it was the BT and GMO corn, stuff like that. The wildlife does not even want to eat it. They let it lay there and rot. They won't come out and eat it like deers and stuff.
They're smarter than we are.
Yep.
Amazing, Dale. Dale, thanks for the story. Thanks for watching Free Speech TV there in Harmony, North Carolina. We'll be right back. Ten minutes before the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And let's check in with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com. Find out what's going on today. This report brought to you by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. And Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped, is with us. Congressman, you have got to get half our audience is watching on TV right now, and they're looking at this static picture of you. And you're such a good-looking guy. We need to get you on Skype. Bob? I put Bob on the air.
I'll have to do that. That would be a good deal.
Okay. All right. You can hear me. So what's up, Bob?
Hello?
Uh-oh. We just lost him. Another reason we should have had him on Skype. His phone just dropped. Oh, my. Well, life in the big city. It's really interesting. During the break, we had a call from a farmer in North Carolina, and he was talking about how they now, in industrial farming practices, they mix sulfuric acid with grains to help break down the starches. Just weird stuff going on in industrial agriculture. Congressman, you there?
Yes. We'll just work on my voice today.
Okay. All right. So what's up?
Well, Tom, it's an unbelievable day, really, up on Capitol Hill. Of course, the president put forth his authorization for use of military force from the White House. And it's really a debate over two conflicting sections, Article 1, Section 8 of the Constitution, Article 2, Section 2. And one says the president, of course, is in charge, commander-in-chief. And then the other one says the Congress has the power to declare war. The actual last resolution was in 1942 in June. So we've had a lot of, quote, wars, that have continued on without any authority.
Right.
But the president sent this over. It's breaking down in the Hill arena to about four different ways. I think the fourth is the most fascinating question asked. But one is, you know, members who are saying when the president says that this will not be, you know, a forever enduring type of situation, they want more definition. They're afraid of the fact that it's just not defined enough. Then you have the John McCain's of the world who, you know, want the mention of nuclear buttons in any issue that you deal with. And the other set is between both parties of people who are gun-shy over what happened with Iraq and the obvious Bush lies about weapons of mass destruction, and you know, they're gun-shy with that historically.
Right.
The fourth one, I think, is quite fascinating, actually. I doubt anybody will really want to address this that much, but freshman Representative Ted Lieu of California that took Henry Waxman's seat,
mm-hmm.
he said, and this was the quote, that does this represent a direct, grave threat to our nation? And I think that is tending to be the jackpot question versus what's going to be in this resolution, how they're going to either strengthen it or weaken it.
Well, and this is what Bernie Sanders is saying. This isn't our war. This is the Middle Eastern war, and the fourth largest military budget in the world is held by Saudi Arabia. Let them fight their damn war.
Exactly. It is regional. So, you know, the question is raised by the senator and also by the congressman from California, I think is the biggest question. But again, on Capitol Hill, a lot of people aren't going to want to address that. You know, they're not going to want to do that. So the president sent this over. They're going to go through, you know, different amendments, et cetera, and then eventually send it back. But I thought that, you know, what the senator and the congressman from California said was pretty appropriate to, you know, report today in the news. It may not get that much attention, but it is the key question.
I agree.
The other fascinating thing is it's sort of a I told you so by people who told the speaker, but now as the Speaker of the House, John Boehner is blaming the Democrats who need to get off their rear ends, and he said another word at the press conference. He's actually fuming at Mitch McConnell because on the Republican side of those who control the Senate now, and Senator Kirk, who is, you know, not exactly a moderate of any type in the Senate, Republican, and Senator Kirk said, you know, that's it. We're going to have a clean resolution. We don't need to go down this path.
We're talking about the which resolution?
Homeland Security. Mm-hmm. No, I'm sorry. Yes, Homeland Security.
Okay.
And this is a huge deal because the House, who, you know, passed this and wanted to hold the president hostage and change his mind on immigration, now has really, no matter what they say in a press conference, the Senate, also Republicans, to kill their own method of operation to hold the president hostage. So it simply didn't work. It was something of a real lack of any.
So wait a minute. The House and Senate both passed funding to, because the Department of Homeland Security and the FBI and everything else, it all runs out at the end of this month. February 27th. They both passed budgets that would fund it, but the House budget said, oh, and by the way, you can't use any of this money or whatever, however they said it. You can't have the Dreamers program. You can't allow some of these immigrants to stay in the country or the children of these immigrants. And the Senate did not do that. Do I have that right?
And that's right. Now the Senate is going to formally move, but what has happened is, as Boehner was yelling about the Democratic side getting off their rear ends, and they vote no all the time.
Right.
It's fascinating him saying that. Mitch McConnell, the Republican leader, said, clean bill. We're not going to have all the extra material.
So is this going to go back to conference, or are they asking the House to re-vote on the bill?
Well, they're going to send a clean bill, and then if Speaker Boehner wants a conference, he can call one, or he can let, you know, this run out, and then Homeland Security has no funding. So I think this complete political monkey is right back on the House's back, and the Senate's made a move that the House can't win.
Yeah, my prediction is Boehner's going to pass a clean bill, and he's going to come up with something else to be the spectacle of the day so nobody notices.
Exactly. And so
probably Netanyahu or something.
If this is how the whole new Congress is going to operate, then I think the Republicans are finding out that governing is not as easy. It's probably easier when they just said no to everything.
Yeah.
And then the final story, too, you know, when is something a hate crime in the family of the slain children, you know, of the two girls that were sisters, and, of course, there was also a man involved who was slain. They're saying this was a hate crime, And it was because, you know, this man was an atheist who didn't, you know, have any loving ideas at all about anything to do with religion. So we're going to see that debate continue to rage on the three Muslim students that were killed.
That's going to be very interesting. Bob Ney, Congressman, thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
And let me remind people, Bob Ney is the author of the book Sideswipe, which you need to read if you want to know what's going on in Washington, D.C. We'll be back with more right after this.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, the third hour of our program, and... Oh, a quick announcement. This came across my email today. But this is very entertaining. Lunch with Dr. Arthur Laffer, a discussion on free trade, Capitol Hill Visitor Center. Please join us Thursday, February 12th. It's too late. It happened 2 hours ago. At noon in SVC 200 in the Capitol Hill Visitor Center for a lunchtime lecture by Dr. Arthur Laffer, father of supply-side economics and author of The Laffer Curve. Right. My response? Right. Really? You want us to take advice from Arthur Laffer? Really? Meanwhile, you know, we have an... If I only had a brain alert, here it is.
I have so got brains.
Well, why don't you use them?
Go!
I haven't got a brain.
Dumbest thing ever.
Because I haven't got a brain.
That's the dumbest thing I ever heard.
Oh, if I only had a brain.
Well, you know, in the Netherlands, you can grow up to 5 pot plants in your house. Sort of like, you know, Oregon or Washington State or whichever one, you know, who's got fairly liberal laws, and pretty much anybody can possess it. It's no big deal. But if you have 500 plants in your house, you are breaking the law. And the way they discovered this, and it's a shame I can't show you the picture because it's in the news here. There's this apartment building with a slanted roof, you know, a peaked roof on the top of it. And you see, and there's snow on the roof, right? And there's snow on apartment 1 and snow on apartment 2 and snow on apartment 3 and apartment 4. The windows are blacked out and there's absolutely no snow on the roof. It's totally dry. And then apartment 5, normal apartment, and there's snow on the roof. And the police looked at that and said, what are they doing upstairs there? Turned out they had the grow lights going full tilt boogie, and it was melting the snow. Yeah. Oh, well. Yeah. Yeah. There's a very poignant, meaningful, consequential, important question being asked over on Huffington Post. Nick Wing is the author of this. And it's the title of it is Police Stop You While You're Carrying a Bunch of Cash. What happens to your money? Well, I'll tell you the answer very quickly is they can steal it. Whether it's $200 or whether it's $200,000, if the police find you with a lot of money, they can steal it. They can take it and keep it. And you can go through a whole lot of hell to get it back. And if it's only a few hundred or a few $1,000s, and you have to hire a lawyer, I mean, you may have to spend $5,000 or $10,000 in legal fees to get back the $2,000 that the police stole from you, which is why about 90% of the time when the police confiscate stuff, even when there's no conviction, even when there's no demonstrated crime, they get to keep it. Now, this started during the Reagan era. Surprise! Another wonderful thing that Ronnie brought us. And it has gone nuts to the point where in places like Ferguson, Missouri, for every 1,000 residents, there's 1,500 arrest warrants. And, you know, once you get in that system, you know, you don't pay your traffic ticket or you don't pay your jaywalking ticket or whatever, then they come after you. And if you've got any money, when they stop you, they steal whatever you've got. And I thought the, you know, one of the most amazing pieces of this article was, and rather sad, actually, was toward the end. He writes, so you're stopped by police while carrying a bunch of cash. What can you do? You can't do anything. It's not illegal to carry around a lot of cash. But under these Reagan-era rules, which have been promulgated across the United States, and what these local police departments do is they book this stuff with the feds, and then the feds say, okay, fine, you can keep it. This was Reagan's contribution to it. They can basically steal anything they want from you. Your home, your car, your money. They more often take cash, but, you know, hey, you got a pocket full of diamonds, you got some gold coins, whatever you may have, if it's got value, they will steal it. Now, we've been talking for a long time on this program about how America is, you know, as a consequence of 35 years of Reaganomics, the average of middle class, the average working American, we've gone from one person working, being able to support a family in 1980, to now it requiring more than two people to support a family here in 2015. So we've seen that transition. Household income has stayed the same, but individual wages have dropped. So you're seeing the third worldification of the American workforce. You're also seeing the third worldification of our business practices. FDR said you should have a right to engage in business without monopolistic competition. Well, we used to have that right. Reagan did away with that one, too, in 83 when he stopped enforcing the Sherman Act. And now malls are no longer filled with small local businesses. Downtowns are no longer filled with small local businesses. All you can find, or pretty much most of what you find, are big chains, national chains. And it looks like it's hundreds of different chains. They're all owned by maybe six companies. There's 12 companies that control more than 80% of all consumer products in the United States. There's fewer than a dozen companies that control more than 11,000 magazines and publications. It looks like there's all these brands. We have this illusion of choice. But no, not so much. We are, as the result of Republican austerity now, and 35 years of Reaganomics, and this free trade nonsense that the Republicans started with permanent normal trade relations with China that Richard Nixon kicked off and Reagan took viral, I mean, just put on steroids. And then, you know, NAFTA, CAFTA, SHAFTA, you know, Bill Clinton. I mean, it's all of this stuff. And Clinton was just, you know, going along with the Republican program. I mean, they've got so much power now because of the Supreme Court, because the Supreme Court gave them the ability to buy votes, gave billionaires the ability to buy members of Congress. And those members of Congress now, through gerrymandering, they're choosing their voters rather than the other way around. It has reached the point where we live in a third world country, or we're very rapidly living in a third world country. China now has a middle class that's larger than the entire population of the United States, while a fifth of the United States, and some numbers indicate a fourth, it's certainly a fourth of children in the United States, are living in poverty, have fallen out of the middle class. It's time for us to wake up and say no. No, not only are we repudiating Reaganism and voodoo economics, and we're going to roll back the Reagan tax cuts, and we're going to start enforcing the laws and the rules that allowed capitalism to function reasonably well. Ask somebody who was alive in the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, even the early 80s. What was America like? Did we have a banking crisis every 10, 15 years? No. From the George Washington administration till the Franklin Roosevelt administration, this country never went more than 15 years without a nationwide banking collapse. Every 15 years, or 10 or 12 or whatever it would be, we had a major nationwide crash. From the FDR administration until the Reagan administration, no crashes. Why? Because we regulated capitalism. We said, yeah, you can make money, you can get rich, you can run a business. In fact, we would like you to. But here's the rules that you have to operate under. And now you got these billionaires coming along going, oh, but there should be a free market. We should be able to make the rules. Right. It's like having the New England Patriots make the rules for football. Just for them. Right? Oh, yeah, our balls get inflated to 2.5 pounds. Everybody else's is 10. Wait a minute, what happened to the rules? Oh, it's a free market. By the way, we get first down on a 5-yard run. We don't need to run 10 yards. It's a free football game.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
It's time for us to start establishing the rights of Americans. Welcome back. Willis, watching Free Speech TV in Milwaukee. Hey, Willis. Thanks for watching Dish Network. What's
hey,
up?
How you doing, Tom?
What's up?
Can you hear me?
I hear you just fine, Willis.
Okay. I've been listening to you nearly every day, and I think you're a good person as far as the message that you have.
But
I wanted to say something about the IBS. I have that.
Mm-hmm. Irritable bowel syndrome, IBS.
Yes, and I got that, and I cannot eat high fructose corn syrup, dextrose, or sucrose. I have to watch out for those products.
Yeah. I know three people who had IBS for years, one of them for 2.5 decades, and all three of them, it went away when they quit eating wheat, when they went on a gluten-free diet. You might want to, you know, I can't offer you medical advice, Willis, but I can tell you, I don't know anybody who hasn't been cured of their IBS by going gluten-free.
Okay, another thing I wanted to say about when you said Al Gore versus Bush, I do know before then there was a popular vote, but then it was changed to electoral vote. That's why he ended up losing, right?
Well, yes and no. Now, the Electoral College has been with us since the founding of the Republic. The thing is, what really caused this crisis was that Jeb Bush ordered Catherine Harris, his Secretary of State, to knock 80,000 African-Americans off the voting rolls in Florida about 6 weeks before the election. She did that. She did that using a Texas company with a list of Texas felons and matched anybody in Florida who had a name that was similar to a felon from Texas. And so all of the common African-American names, these people just got knocked off the voting rolls. 80,000 people showed up, thought they voted, and their votes never got counted. And to this day, many of them don't even know that they got their votes stolen. As a result of that, George W. Bush was within a few hundred votes of Al Gore. When they counted, and then they started, then the state Supreme Court in Florida said, okay, count every single vote in the state. And they were in the process of doing that, and Tom DeLay and his buddies went down and started banging on the ceilings and on the doors and things, you know, the Brooks Brothers riot. And John Roberts, who was an obscure lawyer, went down to Florida and taught the lawyers who were going to argue Bush v. Gore, because he used to be the clerk for Rehnquist, the Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. He went down and taught them how to argue Rehnquist, and then they went up and they had Bush v. Gore. But a year later, you know, and the Supreme Court said George Bush is president. A year later, though, the New York Times actually counted all those votes that the Florida Supreme Court had wanted to count, and sure enough, Al Gore won. Back to you, Willis.
I have one more last thing.
Sure.
Regarding Judge Thomas and the Supreme Court, it seems like this guy has really sold out the Voting Rights Act, which blacks along with whites really died for. This is very sad.
Yeah, I agree. I don't understand Clarence Thomas. I, you know, I... And maybe it's particularly hard because I'm a white guy and he's an African American. But it's just, I don't understand Clarence Thomas. And I don't want to speculate about why he may be the way he is. I think Scalia is just a curmudgeon. Because I just don't know. I just don't know. But I think it's a tragedy the way, you know, that he's on our Supreme Court and the damage that he's doing. Willis, thank you for the call. Good to hear from you. 20 minutes past the hour. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. Establishing rights, the right to a job. No, it's not in the Constitution right now. I'm saying it should be. President Roosevelt proposed amending the Constitution to say that you have a right to a job that pays well. And if you can't find one, the government will provide one for you. You have a right to health care. And if you can't get it, the government will provide it for you. You have the right to housing. And if you can't afford it, you can't get it, the government will provide it for you. You have a right to food, and you have a right to an education. And I realize I'm talking to an American audience here, and people are going, what the hell is he talking about? That's not in the Constitution. Where'd that come? What? Right to a job? A right to a house? Really? Well, not necessarily a house, but at least a place to live. Every developed country in the world, except the United States, recognizes these rights for their citizens. Every developed country in the world. Now, the EU is aggressively, and the International Monetary Fund are aggressively trying to strip countries of those rights. For example, they said to Greece, your national health care program, if somebody loses their job, which is about half of Greece now, it's a quarter total, but it's half of the young people. If somebody loses their job, 1 year later, they lose their health insurance, period. No free health clinics, nothing. Why? Because the rules are being written by the banksters. And the banksters are the rich guys, and they're doing it for the rich guys. But this is not, you know, this sounds to Americans, this sounds like radical stuff, only because the real radicals, the right-wingers, the billionaires, and these guys who are running around, they have so succeeded in convincing us. Oh, I'm successful. I made it on my own, right? I mean, if I was a right-wing talk show host, I would be talking like that, right? I made it on my own. I make a good living. I made it on my own. I built this show. Well, yeah, I did. But, you know, I'll also tell you that there's no doubt in my mind that if I had not been born white, if I had not been born male, if I had not been born in the United States, if my father had not had a good union job by the time I was 6 years old, that in all probability, I mean, you know, it's possible I'd be here, but I'd be the outlier. I'd be the case that proves the case that proves the point, the exception that proves the point, excuse me. That I'm here because I stood on the shoulders of others. I'm here because I exploited the privilege that I was born with, as well as any natural talent I may have. Yeah, there's a lot of white people out there who can't make good talk show hosts or authors. I get that. You know, I have some skills. But there's a lot of people with skills like that. And if they have dark skin, or if they talk in a way that doesn't sound like me, or that doesn't sound like, you know, Midwestern English, or if they had the misfortune of being born in Bangladesh, they're never going to have the kind of success that I've had in my life. And I think that's the difference between progressives and conservatives, is that progressives will acknowledge that it takes a society to have a society. I have been on unemployment. It wasn't very long. It was maybe 3 months. I was 20 years old. But I lost a job and I was living on my own. And actually, I was living with Louise, as I recall. We were not yet married. And we needed, you know, a little bridge to get us through. It was somewhat embarrassing showing up at the unemployment office and standing in line every week. And it would have been horrible if I'd had to pee in a cup. I mean, that you know, what, like I'm a criminal? And when I was a little kid, when my dad was selling Rex Airs and World Book Encyclopedias door to door, every Saturday we'd go down to the government surplus food shop and we'd pick up a 5-pound brick of American cheese and a 20-pound bag of dried macaroni and all that kind of stuff. On the weekends, we'd visit the Salvation Armies to get our clothes as well as the books that my dad was collecting. And then he got a good job. He got a good union job when I was 6 years old. Everything got better. I was still having, you know, my dad and mom raised 4 boys in a 3-bedroom, 1-bath house. Looking back on it, I'm like, whoa, I wouldn't want to do that right now. But they did a wonderful job. But it's not, I can't say I did this. You know, this was the slogan that the Republicans tried to roll out for Mitt Romney. Remember that? Mitt Romney was trying to pitch himself as a self-made man. His father only gave him $1 million when he went off to college. Or was it $100,000? It was $1 million, yeah. His father gave him $1 million when he went off to college, and he was living very frugally, right? I mean, he's only got 7 houses, I think. One of them that has, what, a 4-car garage elevator? So anyhow, he was trying to pitch himself as, I'm the everyman. I lifted myself by, and they had this slogan, we made this. Right? In response to Hillary Clinton and Barack Obama saying, no, we all made this. And we all did. We're all in this together. And here in the United States, we have had this right-wing theology of individualism shoved down our throats for so long, and it is killing us. It's causing suicides. It's causing homicides. It's destroying our economy. Our businesses are going over offshore. Our jobs are going offshore. This right-wing ideology is killing the United States as we know it. And it's time for us to start talking back to it.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 202-536-2370.
And one starting point would be to say the economy is here to serve society, not the other way around. Let's get our priorities straight. Let's put it in law. Taking back to mainstream media, 3 hours a day, 5 days a week. Tom Hartman here with you. Welcome back. And Matt in Springfield, Virginia. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind?
Hi, I was going to make the comment that to a capitalist, the answer to your questions about farms is the same as your question about rights to an education or a job, that the proper application of free market techniques, mass production would come up with the best solution.
And you are asserting that?
Well, no. I would say that it obviously hasn't worked,
right.
But it's a religion. Like communism, doesn't the capitalists think that if it's just done right, the state will wither away?
Well, I'm not sure. In communism, no, the state doesn't wither away. The state becomes what owns everything, but the state is supposed to be the perfect representative of the people. It didn't work out that way, but, you know, that's how it was supposed to be. But I think The thing that everybody gets hung up on is this phrase free market. There is no such thing as a free market. Somebody has to establish the rules of the marketplace. And there are rules for agriculture. What kind of poison can you put on your fields? What, you know, how does it affect downriver runoff? How does it affect the food? What kind of quality of food can you produce and sell? How do you label it? What do people have to know about what's in it, what isn't in it? Are there humane ways to have, you know, animals in factory farm or in any kind of farming? All these kind of things, these are the rules of the marketplace. There is no free marketplace. And I think the question that we have to ask ourselves is, should the rules of the marketplace be established so that they optimize the possibility of a small number of very large corporations and very wealthy individuals getting rich? Or should the rules of the marketplace be optimized so that the largest number of possible people, working people and consumers, can have a good job for the working people and have a safe product for the consumers? And I would argue it should be the latter. And Republicans, conservatives, and so-called free market idealists argue it should be the former. Am I making sense, Matt?
Yes, but if I can say a but, isn't it a beguiling notion that Reaganomics offers to the citizen? You don't have to think about anything. You simply let the market go out and do those wonderful things, and you'll end up paying less taxes. It's like eating your way to thinness.
Right, yeah, and this was what's so seductive. I mean, you go back to von Mises or Hayek, you know, or in the more modern era, Milton Friedman, and essentially what these guys were saying is that the market magically fixes things, and if you could just get government out of the way, the market will fix things. And what they the rationale, which Alan Greenspan echoed some years ago in a piece in the Wall Street Journal, actually sounds very thoughtful and sensical. He said, you know, in the marketplace, there are a trillion decisions being made by a trillion, you know, by billions of individuals literally every minute. And that collective intelligence, all of those people making decisions in what they think is their best interest, that is going to trump the ability of any kind of central planner to decide how a society should run or how a business should run. Well, yeah, there's a lot of truth to that. The problem is that those decisions are not about the rules of the marketplace. Those decisions are being made within the rules of the marketplace. In other words, people are going into stores and they're saying, okay, do I buy Brawny or do I buy, you know, some other, you know, I don't know, brands of paper towel, but, you know, which one am I going to buy? Okay, so that's decision making. But they're not making a decision about how much waste the paper plants, how much effluent they could dump in the rivers and things. And so we're, you know, we think that this free market thing is going to fix things, but the free market, you know, a truly, quote, free market means a market owned and run by a small number of people. And that's a toxic and dangerous thing. And that's the area that we're going to. This is why I've been talking so much lately about authoritarian capitalism, because that's the end game. The end game is Singapore and China. The end game is Mussolini and Franco and Hitler. The end game is the government supporting business at the expense of the average working person and at the expense of consumers. Matt, great point. Thank you for the call. Tony in Stafford, Virginia. Hey, Tony, what's up?
Yeah, my question is, a lot of what you were talking about, your rant,
mm-hmm.
Well, the main thing that makes me mad is how are you going to get people to start registering to vote and getting out in November and voting for candidates that will look after their interest.
Yeah, here's the big problem that we have, Tony. When the Supreme Court legalized bribery of politicians, and there's really no other way to say it, when the Supreme Court did that, it caused a lot of Americans to sit up and go, really? You know, rich guys can now buy politicians? And then the news media promotes the fact that, you know, hey, Shelley Adelson, he's got his billions of dollars that he made in China with his casinos in Macau, and he's bringing that Chinese money back to the United States, and he's going to support Mitt Romney, or he's going to support Newt Gingrich for a month or so, and so he's in the Republican primary, and then he's going to support Rick Santorum, and so Rick Santorum has a moment in the primary, and then you know, last week the Koch brothers say, oh, we're going to raise $900 million, and we're going to basically buy the elections or determine who's going, and the average American is looking at this going, I don't have $900 million. I don't have $1 billion. I can't afford to keep, you know, a candidate for president of the United States in a primary race for months at a time. I can't afford to bankroll 5 senators and 25 members of the House. I can't do any of it. So to hell with it. I mean, why should I even bother to vote? Which is exactly what the billionaires want people to say. They want there to be cynicism. This is why they run largely negative advertising instead of positive advertising. These ads that you see from these PACs, these political action committees, for the and they have half of them have the word freedom in their name. All these right-wing Koch brothers funded or Koch brother inspired right-wing PACs, they are almost always negative advertising. They're attacking somebody or criticizing somebody. Why? Because that drives down voter participation. It causes people to be more cynical. So, Tony, the answer to your question, how do we get people involved in politics, is we have to clean up politics to the point where the average American believes that their vote actually matters. Because the reality, the average American may be very cynical, but they're right.
Wait, just one second.
Yeah.
There's one flaw to that thinking. You have to have an educated voter.
Yes.
Somebody who takes an interest in politics. You know, you look at the last election. You had Scott Walker in Wisconsin. You had Brownback in Kansas and Scott in Florida. Everybody knew their track record from the previous 4 years, but still they got reelected.
Because of all the money that came in.
Yeah, but if you know the guy's track record, they could spend their entire fortune advertising good things about him, and you know exactly what he's going to do. Yeah. You follow my point? You know?
I do, and you're right. The average American doesn't realize that, you know, they think that the agenda of the Republican Party is to have fewer abortions, or they think the agenda of the Republican Party is to not let immigrants into the United States. Well, the real agenda of the Republican Party is to make the rich rich and screw the average working person. It's very simple. It's always been that way, as Harry Truman pointed out, and it always will be that way. But to finish my thought, Tony, I really believe that if we can get money out of politics, if you go back and you look at when, for example, in 1919 or 1920, when the 19th Amendment was passed, the direct election of senators, there was an increase in voter participation as a result of that. People were looking at this going, hey, our political process is not as corrupt as it used to be. I'm going to get involved. We have a cynicism problem because we have a corruption problem, and everybody knows it. I mean, I talk to cab drivers here in D.C. Everybody knows it. You know, this town is bulging and bursting with money because you can, you know, buying politicians is the most profitable return on investment, the greatest return on investment in business in the United States right now is buying politicians, buying laws. And we need to undo that. And that's movetoamend.org. That is reversing Citizens United. Tony, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Bill in Clifton, New Jersey. Hey, Bill, what's up?
Hey, Tom, just a fast one. I don't know, you know, legally the Declaration of Independence, how it works with our government.
It has no legal standing.
Mission statement or not, but it does say that when it talks about inalienable rights, it's not just talking about life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Those are examples that it gives. There's much more rights that it's alluding to that should be pretty obvious.
I agree. Bill, here's the thing. The Declaration of Independence is our founding document, or one of our founding documents, but it is not a legal document. The Constitution is the legal document. And so regardless of what the Declaration says, you have to look to the Constitution. But the Constitution, in two different places, in the preamble, which is where the authors of the Constitution were saying, here's why we're doing this. It says, we are establishing this government for ourselves to promote the general welfare. And then in Article 1, Section 8, where it establishes all the things that Congress can do, it says, and Congress can appropriate money and spend money to do whatever it in its own best wisdom. I'm paraphrasing. Yeah, this is my language, not the Constitution's, but you can read it. It's right there. To promote the general welfare. It's right there in Article 1, Section 8. So you get these people who are like, where's the enumerated power to have Social Security? It's right there in Article 1, Section 8. It promotes the general welfare. So, you know, we already have the legal basis for this bill. What we don't have is the ability to push back on the billionaires who have captured our political process because of the Supreme Court. Bill, thank you for the call. It's great to hear from you. We'll be back. It's 15 minutes before the end.
You're listening to Tom Hartman. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
The chief of Sony, a woman, is defending paying women less? Really? Interesting news. Welcome back, 15 minutes before the hour. Tammy in Spirit Lake, Iowa, watching us on Free Speech TV. What's on your mind, Tammy?
Oh, hey, Tom. I was just listening to you talking about the farms, and, of course, the reality of what's going on here in northwest Iowa is, again, the farms are disappearing. It's just all turning into corn and beans, GMO, I'm certain. The city of Des Moines, our capital city here, is suing. I'm not sure if it's the Branstad administration or DNR, but their water is so toxic from nitrates that they can't even afford to clean it anymore.
Wow.
And, yeah, the county that I live in is a very unique county because we have a beautiful lake here with multi-million dollar properties, and the Learjets fly in, and we're under siege for more hog lots. Now, apparently, since 2013, Iowa farmers have filed nearly 700 construction applications for new or expanded hog buildings, which is a six-fold increase from 5 years earlier.
Mm-hmm.
That's what the records show. So, you know, like this latest one that we've been fighting is, you know, they literally want to spray the manure into the watershed of the lake area, which will contaminate our lake. And, of course, you know, they tell us how safe it is. It's really hard to – I don't know how to fight big ag, you know. The other reality is, guess who's working in these hog barns? It's the Mexicans who have very little pay, absolutely no health insurance.
Right.
No, they really can't say anything because, you know, they're here illegally. This is Steve King's district, and the folks who own these hog barns are profiting off this labor, this cheap labor, in a huge way.
In Steve King's district. Maybe we should get Steve King on and ask him about that.
Well, you know, he hasn't been on in a while, but...
Yeah, he hasn't.
Well, he doesn't. Well, I popped over to Joni Ernst. You know, she's my new senator. Her Facebook page recently, and she was touting something about, you know, the Keystone XL pipeline and how fabulous it was. And as I looked down the comments, there were so many more no's than yes, Joni.
Right.
And yet she can, you know, she's obviously not going to listen to
us. She doesn't care what the people think. She's a Republican.
And neither does Steve King. But the audacity of him to say that they have, you know, calves the size of cantaloupes carrying drugs instead of, you know, what they're putting up with in the hog barns that are...
They actually have biceps the size of cantaloupes because they're working in the hog farms doing hard labor for crappy pay because Steve King's Republican buddies are exploiting them.
It's so true. And, you know, when I grew up in the 60s and 70s, and then, you know, every farmer had pigs and chickens and cattle, and, you know, now the farmers live in town in big fancy houses, and they don't even live on their farms anymore.
Right.
And a lot of that land has been passed on to kids who, they don't live on the farm, they just pay, you know, some cooperative to go out and farm it. And since GMOs, we get sprayed in the spring. We have airplanes that spray in the middle of the summer, and then they get sprayed again in the fall. I mean, the chemicals have increased, not decreased.
Right, yeah. So you're at Ground Central for Toxic Industrial Agriculture.
Yes.
That's amazing. Tammy, thank you for the story. Thanks for sharing that with us. And thanks for giving me something to go after Steve King with. We'll see how that plays out. It's 10 minutes before the hour. We'll be right back. Tom Harbin here with you, 10 minutes before the hour, and Matt in East Jordan, Michigan. Hey, Matt, what's on your mind? Matt, listening to Sirius, you want to talk about factory farming? Matt is not there. Roger in Forest Lake, Minnesota, listening on KTNF. Hey, Roger, what's on your mind today?
Hi, Tom. I just really enjoy your program, and I got your book, The Crash of 2016. That's a seems like should be a must reading for everybody.
Thank you.
But I just wanted to comment about the free market thing. It seems like the mortgage derivative market was unregulated, a free market, and you could kind of see what happened when with that market and its self-correction.
That is an excellent point, Roger. That is an absolutely excellent point. Thank you for making it. One of the more profound comments today. Brilliant. Thank you. Richard, in driving through Texas, listening on Sirius. Hey, Richard, you wanted to get back to the police officers stealing your money?
Yeah. I heard an interview with someone recently that is doing a report on this stuff. And apparently he was saying that there is a officer who used to be with the California Highway Patrol that is now going around nationwide to different police departments, explaining to them exactly how to profile people who may be carrying large sums of money just for these kinds of seizures.
Wow. And just so they can steal your money, basically.
Yeah, he documented a story of these two guys that were driving through, I want to say, Missouri or Iowa or somewhere. And the guys were professional poker players. They go to these tournaments all over the country and play poker. They were carrying over $90,000 in cash in a briefcase.
Right.
The police stopped them, searched their vehicle, found the briefcase, threatened to destroy the briefcase if the guy didn't give them the combination to open it, found the $90,000, seized it, and only gave them back $10,000 if they signed, or no, they gave them back everything but $10,000 if they signed a document that said they wouldn't press charges against the police. And these guys were never charged with anything.
Right.
Nothing at all. The police, apparently the police found like less than a gram of marijuana in the vehicle, and the guy had a medical marijuana card from California. And you know, it was like the police even notified the authorities in California that they suspected these guys of being big time drug dealers, and the authorities in California raided the guy's house.
Amazing. Amazing.
And they were never charged with anything in the state that they were stopped in.
We have totally jumped the shark in this country. And this is the criminal justice system that preys on little people. It preys on average people. It preys on working people. It preys on poker players. Then there's the criminal justice system that HSBC went before, where they laundered hundreds of millions of dollars for narco traffickers, murderers, gang members, rogue states like North Korea. And they get a slap. They pay a small fine, and not one single name, not one single bankster is named in that criminal complaint, and nobody goes to jail. This is we're not just an oligarchy, Richard. We have become a kleptocracy, a government that steals from its own people. It's a horrible thing. Richard, thank you for the call. Thanks for the heads up on that. John in Gilbert, Arizona. Hey, John, what's up?
Hey, Tom. Great show. I love your show. You're a wonderful person. Thank you.
Thank you.
I wanted to share that I don't think as a U.S. citizen we should have to register to vote. I think that should be a privilege. And if there wants to be an audit from time to time, just like on taxes, then so be it. But I think this should be.
You mean it should be a right, not a privilege? I agree with you.
Yes, correct.
Yeah, I agree with you. The whole idea of registering to vote seems silly to me. You just show up and vote. And in North Dakota, they have same-day registration. You show up, you register, you vote all at once. And in North Dakota, they have no voter ID laws. And North Dakota is a very red state. Why aren't the Republicans hysterical about voter ID laws in North Carolina? Well, North Dakota, because North Dakota is mostly white. And,
say one more thing.
Yeah, go for it, John.
Tom, I just want to say thank you so much for all you do. Your show is just wonderful, and I just really appreciate it.
Thank you. Thank you for your kind words. Finish my thought, the single largest predictor of where, Koch brother money through the American Legislative Exchange Council is going to be the next state that's going to be pushing voter ID suppression, voter suppression laws with ID, is which states have large black populations. It's that simple. Just take a look. Either large black populations or large progressive populations in the form of unionized working people and young people, which is the case in Wisconsin. Sunny in Riverside, California. Hey, Sunny. What's up? We got a minute until
Hi. Okay, and then two things.
If we're talking about voting is one of the basic things that go along with democracy, there's this gentleman, Jonathan Simon, who did numerous paperwork on voting experience and said how it's done in secret and there's no oversight. And he's a graduate of Harvard University, and he's for election reform.
Yeah.
And also the other thing is Paul Hellyer, the ex-defense minister of Canada, made this YouTube, The Money Mafia, and it tells all about how if Americans don't rise up in unity very soon, that they're about ready to take over, and everybody should watch it if they want to be responsible.
Okay.
The Money Mafia, it's just a YouTube video,
yeah.
And it'll tell exactly what they, you know.
Got
anyway,
it,
son. You know.
Thank you very much. It's you don't even need the conspiracy theories. I mean, you can have them, you can follow them, you can pursue them, the New World Order, the bankers, the Bilderbergers, all this. This is all being done right out in the open. The Koch brothers announce that they're going to raise almost $1 billion to buy our elections. It's like they're saying, you know, democracy in America, that's a joke. We own the democracy. Anyhow, thanks for being with us these 3 hours today. Thanks so much. Do appreciate your company. And I look forward to seeing you tomorrow. In the meantime, don't forget democracy starts with you. Tag your it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, visit TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.